to destroy the church, just kill it. And he failed. So then he went away to do war with her seed. And I think that this has to do with the temptations of the devil that he exerts and puts before ordinary Christians, and actually probably is the way that most people are going to wind up being captured by him and caused to go to hell. It's through the temptations and things like that that he puts before them. So we have the dragon, 12. We have the two beasts in chapter 13, the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. And then in 14:8, specific mention of Babylon, but it is mentioned in terms of fallen. Fallen is Babylon the Great. But we don't read at that point of any detailed description of the fall of Babylon. And then when he begins to go into detail to look at the fall, the defeat of these various enemies, the first one that he deals with is Babylon. And then he's going to deal with the two beasts, and then he will deal with the dragon. So that means that he will take the order in which he introduced them, and he will deal with their judgment in the reverse order. Okay? So 14:8 mentions that judgment, but we don't read about that judgment until we get into chapter 17. Now in 15 and 16, we have the bowls of wrath being poured out. And in chapter 17 and verse 1, there came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls and spake with me, saying, come hither, I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters. So he introduces now that that's what's going to be shown. And so in 17 and 18, that's what we're looking at. And so you studied 17, you saw the picture of the woman sitting on the scarlet-colored beast, sitting on many waters. And down in verse 15 of chapter 17, those many waters are identified. The waters which thou sawest, where the harlot sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Now back in chapter 13, when we saw the beast coming up out of the sea, we pointed out at that time that in the prophets and in Revelation, the sea is used to represent society as a whole. Just the society, people of the world as a whole. And out of all the people of the world, there rise up a nation here, an empire here, and then it'll shift, and that one will go down, and another one will come up. So that's the thing here. And contrast the woman, of course, here with the woman that we looked at in Revelation 12, who gave birth to the man-child. And this woman that we see here is quite different from the woman that we read there of in Revelation 12. This woman is a garish-type woman, arrayed in purple and scarlet, decked with gold and precious stone and pearls. Just see the picture of her. And she's sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast. Now the beast and the description we have of him, particularly the idea of seven heads and ten horns, identifies him with that beast that came up out of the sea in chapter 13. And yet this is another aspect. I believe that's really what this is talking about. It is talking about another aspect of world empire. And at this time, the empire was the Roman one. And yet in the book of Revelation, the words that he uses, the terms that he uses, all go to show us that in every world empire, there is an allure. There is an allure to that world empire. And there are people who find that world empire appealing to them, and especially represented in the capital city. Now, in the Old Testament, we have the great city of Nineveh. We have the great city of Babylon. And we also have the great city of Tyre. And in chapter 18, to a great extent here in Revelation, it is the city of Tyre, the description of the city of Tyre and the judgment of God upon the city of Tyre that's used in talking about this city of Babylon, this figurative city of Babylon. And Ezekiel 26 and 27 are the two chapters that really, really, the imagery of chapter 18 is to a great extent rooted in the statements of Ezekiel about Tyre in 26 and 27. Now, when we think about all of this, we have to sort of sort out things a little bit. And really, what's interesting is that when you do sort them out, you will find that they sort out about the same way in our day that they did then. When you think about what are the things that constitute dangers to people today spiritually, well, there are... Or what if you had persecution? There is persecution in some parts of the world, China, Vietnam, where there are brethren, and there is persecution, and other places as well, perhaps. But you also have the appeal. You know, there are people that say, oh, I want to go to New York. New York is where the action is. Well, my question is, what kind of action are you wanting? And there are people who find these great cities to be very alluring. That's where the life is. That's where the action is. Well, it was that way back here too. Even though these great cities back here did not have the conveniences that we have here in Athens. In the context of their day, they represented the height of civilization. And so there was a tempting thing, the wealth. Go to the city and make your fortune. The city not only represented power. Now, you know, grasp that idea. Rome represented power. But Rome also represented worldly allure. It didn't just represent it, it suggested it. It embodied it. So as a child of God today thinks about the dangers that he faces, one of those dangers is the allure of the world. And that allure of the world is the thing that's dealt with in connection with Babylon. Now remember, in the context of that day, they were definitely dealing with a civil power that had lent its power, had given its power to the devil. So here was Rome persecuting the saints. But secondly, Rome was also tempting the saints by putting the allure of power and pleasure, you know, worldly accomplishment, all that put before them. And you know, you can listen at the commercials today, commercials that are made. You can hear people interviewed or whatever. And these same things are there. The things that appeal are the power and the pleasure. And so here they are. And then a third thing is false religion. So the devil is he uses these things any time that he can. And so here in Revelation, we see all three of those things in full use. The power of persecution. The power of false religion. And the power of worldly allurement. So in chapter 17, when he talks about Babylon and describes her as a harlot, the whole idea is that the harlot is, she represents a pleasure. But it is a false pleasure. It's a cheap pleasure. It is not a good pleasure. And she's garishly dressed here. The whole picture is of one who is selling her wares. And there are many who will come to her. And so it describes her in chapter 17. In chapter 18, in verse 2, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Now again, we're looking at an almost a quotation of Isaiah 21 and verse 9. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and is become a habitation of demons and a hold of every unclean spirit and a hold of every unclean and hateful bird. When you go back and read the prophetic descriptions of Babylon in the Old Testament, you will find that that's what they predict about Babylon. Now, the thing to remember about Isaiah is that whatever Isaiah says about Babylon, recall that at the time Isaiah prophesies, Babylon is not the world empire. At the time that Isaiah prophesies, Assyria is the world empire. And Assyria will continue to be the world power for, well, depending on what date you begin from, but for another century or so. If you go from 700 to 600, Nineveh fell in 612. And Isaiah began his prophetic work about 740 or something like that. So from 740 to 700 or so, maybe some even after that. But you see, Babylon wouldn't come on the scene for another 100 years as a world empire. And so that is really startling to realize that when Isaiah deals with Babylon, he's dealing with it prophetically. Babylon hasn't appeared yet as a world empire. There are hints of the coming of Babylon in Isaiah, especially in Isaiah 36 through 39. And in chapter 39, where messengers from Babylon, from Merodach-Baladan, remember those, the story of those messengers coming to Hezekiah? And so there's a hint there that the weather vane is moving from Assyria and swinging around to the future, which is going to be Babylon. But all of the things that Isaiah says are prophetic about Babylon. Babylon has not appeared on the scene yet. And I want you to notice in verse 4 of Revelation 18, we're going to look at a remarkable example of that. I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come forth, my people, out of her, that you have no fellowship with her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues." So now just think, what's that call for? What is God calling His children, His servants, to do? What is He warning them not to do? Come out from Babylon. Now, if Babylon is representing Rome, then is He saying come out physically out of the physical city of Rome? No. What's He saying? Come out of the sinful things that the city offers. Come out of it. Don't partake of the evil of this generation as it is epitomized in the city of Rome, and so on. He's saying, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch no unclean thing, and I will be to you a father, and you shall be to me sons and daughters, as Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, last part of chapter 6. Now then, turn back, please, to Isaiah 52. And we're going to see a really remarkable example of what I was telling you a while ago. In Isaiah 52, now bear in mind that in Isaiah 52, Babylon as an empire is 100 years away or more. And so take up in verse 7. Now what he's going to do in chapter 52, beginning in verse 1, he is proclaiming the freedom, the deliverance of his people from bondage. So in verse 7, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. The voice of thy watchmen, they lift up the voice, together do they sing, for they shall see eye to eye when Jehovah returneth to Zion. And yet they haven't even left yet. But they are going to. And when they leave, they will go into captivity, and then the time will come God will bring them back. And so they haven't even gone yet. The empire is not even actually on the horizon yet. And yet God is taking them on beyond the time of that great empire to the point they will return. And when they're returning, he says, break forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem. For Jehovah hath comforted his people, he hath redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. Now, hold your place right there. We're going to read verse 11, but I'm reminding you that this is what John wrote in verse 4. Of chapter 18, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come forth, my people, out of her, that you have no fellowship with her sins. All right, now here's what Isaiah writes. Depart ye, go ye out from thence. touch no unclean thing. Go ye out of the midst of her. Cleanse yourselves, ye that bear the vessels of the Lord. Now that is the passage that Paul quotes in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 17. Right there is the passage he quotes there. Come ye out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord. Touch no unclean thing. So here the children of Israel will be in Babylon. And in Isaiah, they have been in Babylon. So the time comes for them to be delivered from their bondage. And when they leave Babylon, what are they to leave behind? All of the evil things of Babylon. In other words, when you go to Babylon, you're going to be going there chastised for your sins. Now, when you get there, don't take up with the city in the sense of learning to love the things of Babylon. When you leave Babylon, leave all that stuff behind you. Don't take it with you. Sometimes I have a lesson I preach on Isaiah 52, and basically it's something like, don't take your shackles with you. Don't take your fetters with you. Because the idea is that wherever you have been in captivity, if you leave the captivity, shouldn't you have the idea that I don't want ever anymore to ever see that or have anything to do with it? Don't you think you'd be that way if you had been in physical captivity in a land such as Babylon and you finally got your chance to leave and go back home? Do you think you would want to keep some little memento, maybe your chains, your shackles, your fetters? You're going to have them bronzed and hang them on a nail to remind you of the good times you had in Babylon. Well, this is representing something beyond Babylon. Even in Isaiah, it's representing something beyond Babylon. It's representing the idea of sin itself. That when what God is teaching in Isaiah is, when I deliver you from Babylon, I am also going to deliver you from what else? Sin. And I could deliver you from Babylon, and if I didn't deliver you from sin, you'd still be in as big trouble as ever. Now that's something that's hard for people to grasp. It was hard for Israel to grasp. And it's hard for us to grasp. That God could deliver them from physical bondage, and they'd still be in as big trouble as they ever were. So He says, that is not going to be my main thrust. My main thrust is to deliver you from sin. So depart ye, depart ye. Go out from thence. Touch no unclean thing. And that's why Paul uses this passage in 2 Corinthians 6. Because that's the point. Depart from sin. Well, here's the same idea in Revelation 18:4. Come out. And the reason I'm emphasizing that is that these people who lived at the time that Revelation was written for them, what's one of the great messages that they need to give heed to? Beware of what? The danger of sin. That you may worry more about the persecution. But the persecution can kill your body, but it can't destroy your soul. But what will destroy your soul? Sin. So, you know, in a way, as you think about it, and you say, okay, we're going to have a contest, we're going to have an election, and we're going to decide which one of these beasts or which one of these forces is the most dangerous to the spiritual welfare of Christians. Do you think it's the persecuting power of Rome? Do you think it's the emperor worship, the false religion? Or do you think it is the worldly allure of the temptations of empire, the temptations of wealth, the temptations of power and status and all of that? Well, I don't know that we could necessarily validate our election, but I would say that it would be either the false religion or the allure of the world that would actually wind up being the most dangerous forces for the Christians to face. What do you think? Yes. I think it would be that, or possibly the false religion. I really think the allurement of the world would probably be the most broad-based danger that Christians would face. So that's one of the reasons why he is telling them, come out from among them. you have no fellowship with their sins, and that reminds me of Ephesians 5:11, doesn't you? Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather even reprove them, and that you receive not of her plagues. Now that implies that if we buy into worldly allure, and that's where we make our commitment, and so we share her riches and we share her pleasures, then what else are we going to share? Her condemnation and her judgment. That's right. That's right. All right, now, when he says in verse 18:8, therefore in one day shall her plagues come. Look in verse 10. Standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for in one hour is thy judgment come. And then in verse 17, for in one hour so great riches is made desolate. Well, if you go back to Jeremiah 51, he has that same basic idea. He says, suddenly Babylon will come down. And I think that the suddenly doesn't necessarily mean that, like, everything's going great and suddenly there's an atomic explosion. But it does mean that everything seems to be going great, and suddenly, where that city could not even conceive of a problem, suddenly, unexpectedly, there is a problem. Sort of like Nineveh. I think Nineveh is a good example of that. When the last powerful king of Assyria was Ashurbanipal, and he died around 626 or 7. Now Nineveh fell in 612. And if you had looked at the condition of Assyria at the close of Ashurbanipal's life, it probably was at its broadest extent. You've heard me make that point before, that so often in the history of an empire, at that point where it has reached its very broadest expanse, and you think is therefore its most powerful, it's probably just before falling. Ashurbanipal had gone down. He had subdued Egypt. During his reign, 663, he had destroyed the city of Thebes, an extremely powerful city in Egypt, far down the Nile. And he had gone there, down there and just destroyed it. So everyone would have said, oh, wow, Assyria is just hitting its stride here. But no, it happened much sooner than anyone could have expected and fell more completely than anyone could have expected. So this is not literal Babylon here. This is figurative Babylon. Babylon is here being used to represent, I think, in a way, it embodies the aspects of previous great world cities such as Nineveh, such as Tyre, and such as old literal Babylon. And it is all symbolizing the idea of Rome. And if you were to take the predominant characteristics of those three great cities of old, it would be true that those things were all, to a great extent, combined in Rome. And in a way, this beast of chapter 13 is a combination of the beast that went before. And so you have Nineveh, which was one of the most rapacious cities that ever existed. They lived for conquest and gain. And when they conquered to bring whatever good was there unto themselves. And that was their whole approach. The city of Tyre was the great city of commerce. These were the Phoenicians, and the Phoenicians traded all over the Mediterranean and possibly even out in the Red Sea, out in the Indian Ocean. We don't know yet for sure where all they did go, but they were great seafaring people, and that was Tyre. And so they traded far and wide and brought the things that people liked. Things that people want. And then there was Babylon. Babylon the pleasures of the world. It was the great city, the great beautiful city. All of this combined together here. I don't see any real point to going through and looking at merchandise of gold and silver and stone. What does that represent? Well, I don't think it represents anything. I think it's just the idea of here's the trade. Here's all the stuff that was going on. Things that people like. Things that people want. The other day, I was told, I think this was up in the Nashville area, but someone was telling me about a real estate agent who was showing this woman some property. And so as they were driving out toward the property, the woman suddenly stopped the real estate agent and said, "Now, wait a minute. How far is it from here to a Walmart?" And so the real estate agent had to do some figuring. And the lady said, "I do not want to be farther than," and I don't remember now what the figure was. I think it was like 5 miles or something. "I do not want to be more than 5 miles from Walmart." So, you know, you say, okay, so what's the center of your life? Is it Babylon? Is it Walmart? Now, of course, we go to Walmart. We go to other places. The point is that what we have to understand is the list of all this stuff here, this is the stuff that appealed people, and with some people, it's what they live for. So it's not that to have something of gold is wrong. It's not to have something of silk is wrong. That's not the idea here. But it's when this luxurious living, when it becomes an end within itself, when it becomes the goal, then we have succumbed to the allure of the world. And we have to remember that very carefully, that we not be swept up and taken in with all of these things. And so this condemnation here is being directed to the people who have made these things their lives, their goal. That's what life is all about. To have the latest of everything, to be sure that you're top level of whatever style dictates, that your furniture is the very finest that can be, your cars the very finest, your house the very finest, and nothing else will suffice. That this is what you spend your time thinking about. It's what you spend your time doing. It is what you spend every penny of your money in order to attain. That's what these people were doing. And for these people, when the great city falls, then what happens to all of their stuff? They can't get in anymore. Then what? Their house comes tumbling down, the house of their lives. And so he's already warned the saints, now don't you buy into this. Don't you get in bed with this harlot, Babylon. And numbers of times here he talks about those who have committed fornication with her and so on. He's saying, don't you do that. And so he describes all of those things. And then verse 14, the fruit which thy soul lusted after are gone from thee, and all things that were dainty and sumptuous are perished from thee, and men shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things who were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning and saying, woe, woe, the great city, she that was arrayed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stone and pearl. What are the merchants not going to be able to do anymore? Not going to be able to sell their stuff and make their money. What about the shipmaster, everyone that saileth anywhither, and mariners, and as many as gain their living by the sea, stood afar off? They cried out as they looked upon the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city? And they cast dust on their heads. And this sounds so much. In fact, it is definitely an allusion to Jeremiah 51, verses 30 through 32. They cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and mourning. And I'm sorry. It's Ezekiel Ezekiel 27. Let's turn there and read that passage just a moment, just to see that it's almost a quotation. Ezekiel 26 and 27 are the great chapters dealing with Tyre. So in Ezekiel 27, beginning in verse 30, "And shall cause their voice to be heard over thee, and shall cry bitterly, and shall cast up dust upon their heads. They shall wallow themselves in ashes." Now that's Ezekiel 27 and verse 30. And back here, "They cast dust on their heads and cried." See that? See, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. So it's definitely an allusion to that. So not only the merchants, but the shipmasters, the sailors, the mariners. And look at the last half of verse 19. "Woe, woe, the great city wherein all that had their ships in the sea were made rich by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate." Now, whereas they are grieving, "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye saints, and ye apostles, and ye prophets, for God hath judged your judgment on her." So the judgment of this woman who has made herself drunk on the blood of the saints, that's back in 17:6. Saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And so they rejoice. And that, what a contrast. That's one of the wonderful things, beautiful, startling, impressive things about Revelation, is how many contrasts there are. And so here you see the contrast, and one of the greatest contrasts of all is the contrast between the future of Babylon, this Babylon here, and the future of heavenly Jerusalem. Right? Quite a contrast in them. The contrast between the people who are involved with this Babylon and the people who enjoy her and who grieve for her being gone, and those, on the other hand, who rejoice that she is gone. "And a strong angel took up a stone, as it were a great millstone, and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with a mighty fall shall Babylon, the great city, be cast down, and shall be found no more at all." Now for that passage, we need to go back to Jeremiah 51 and look at a similar story. A similar story. And it's a very interesting story. By the way, when you are teaching the period of Judah alone, and you're at that time when the captivity is beginning, remember Jeremiah is one of the prophets who actually spans the time before the captivity and into the captivity. So if you're teaching children, there would be a lot of things in Jeremiah you couldn't deal with. They wouldn't get it. But here in Jeremiah 51, there is a story that they could deal with, beginning in verse 59. "The word which Jeremiah the prophet commanded Seraiah, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, when he went with Zedekiah, the king of Judah, to Babylon in the fourth year of his reign." Okay, so here's this guy who's going to go with King Zedekiah to Babylon. He's going to make a trip with him. And his name is Seraiah. He was the chief chamberlain, so he was an official. Jeremiah wrote in a book, meaning in a scroll, in a piece of paper, all the evil that should come upon Babylon, even all these words that are written concerning Babylon. And Jeremiah said to Seraiah, "When thou comest to Babylon, then see that thou read all these words." And it subsequently turns out that the way he's to do it is he's to stand out by the Euphrates River. And he's to stand out there. Seraiah is to take this piece of paper, this scroll that Jeremiah has written by the inspiration of God. He's to read it and say, "O Lord, thou hast spoken concerning this place to cut it off, that none shall dwell therein, neither man nor beast, but that it shall be desolate forever, and it shall be when thou hast made an end of reading this book, that thou shalt bind a stone to it and cast it into the midst of the Euphrates, and thou shalt say, thus shall Babylon sink, and shall not rise again, because of the evil that I will bring upon her, and they shall be weary. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah. So Sirea was to perform this mission for the Lord, to get out here, stand here. I'm assuming he would be standing on the side of the Euphrates where he was looking at Babylon. That, to me, would be more logical. He reads this statement of the Lord, of the doom of Babylon. He takes a rock, wraps the piece of paper around the rock, takes the rock, throws it out there into the Euphrates. It splashes and sinks. And so back here in Revelation, instead of it being a stone, just a little stone that a piece of paper is wrapped around, what is it? It's a millstone. Now, when you threw a millstone in the water instead of a little rock, what would the millstone do when it hit the water? Big splash. Well, see, a strong angel took up a stone, as it were a great millstone, and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with a mighty fall. So that old great big rock falling into that water would make quite a splash. So it's a more emphatic thing here. Thus with a mighty fall shall Babylon, the great city, be cast down and shall be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and minstrels and flute players and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. In other words, all that is associated with a great city, a capital city, a world city, no craftsman of whatsoever craft, shall be found any more at all in thee, and the voice of a mill shall be heard no more at all in thee, and the light of a lamp shall shine no more at all in thee, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride. Now, that literally did eventually happen to Babylon. It certainly happened to Nineveh. It eventually happened to Babylon. The point is not that this would necessarily literally happen to Rome, but the point is that there would be a most definite and a most distinct end to Rome as world city, as world capital, as a city ranking with Babylon. And I mean, you take Rome today. Rome is a large city. But would you rank it with some of the movers and shakers of world history today? No. And so he's talking about an end to the Rome that was then. And when we mention Rome, we're mentioning Rome because it was the one there at the time. The principles that are established here would apply to any world empire that throws its weight and its power against God. But the point being made here, I believe, is this Rome that existed back here. And the message was for these people. But we gain principles from reading those points. Okay, is the final bell, has the second bell rung? One first bell? Okay. And so as he completes the chapter there, the light of a lamp shall shine no more at all in thee, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee, for thy merchants were the princes of the earth. Now see, merchants, the princes. In other words, these were the people who threw in with the power, who threw in with the capital, threw in with the world. These were the princes. They were the merchants. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that have been slain upon the earth. All right, so what we'll see as we go on in 19 is we will see the judgment of God continue now upon the two beasts, the beast of the sea and the false prophet, and then upon the dragon himself. Okay.